Syme. Welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, man. Well, this is a treat. We basically, again, got connected by Cypherpunk Cinema. We'll say that. We'll use his name. Cypherpunk Cinema on Twitter. And he kind of told me that you had been involved with the recent movie and, you know, with Matt Walsh. And so he just basically said, hey, I think you should talk to him. And I just was like, hey, I'd love to. So why don't you introduce yourself for people who aren't familiar with who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I'm Anton Syme. I was the director of photography for both What is a Woman and the new film Am I Racist, put out by Daily Wire, the Matt Walsh movies that are, yeah. It's almost like a series now. Yeah. There's been some, they don't want to call Am I Racist a sequel to What is a Woman, but from my perspective, it kind of always was.
Yeah.
And I'm a, you could call me a hardcore Bitcoin maximalist as well.
Let's go. Wow.
Even though, yeah.
We love it. Okay. So you work on these, you've worked on these two movies. Are these the only two movies you worked on, or do you also have a previous history in Hollywood with, you know, filmmaking?
I live in LA, and in my mind, I work in Hollywood, but kind of the reality for me is it's not that I've been blacklisted from mainstream Hollywood, but I kind of quit pursuing the mainstream thing a long time ago, probably 10 years ago. So, you know, I've been making a living as a director, as a director of photography, as a camera person. And I have my own company where I do kind of commercials, corporate type stuff. And then over the last few years, one of the main things I've done are actually those political commercials that you see during the political season. They've been a little bit of bread and butter work. So, yeah, I did a movie with the director of What is a Woman? Am I Racist? Justin Fope. We did No Safe Spaces. And we did that through his previous company, which is the company that does a lot of those political commercials.
Okay.
So we also did a movie on the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which...
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it was, we put a lot of love and effort into this movie that's on Fox Nation. So technically, this is our fourth movie together.
Okay.
And then I've done some of my own films on, you know, that I've worked on. I've shot other people's films. I mean, I've been a cinematographer for 20 years now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so we can people find you on IMDb? Like, look you up?
They can, yeah.
Hear this name? Okay.
Perfect. Yeah. I have my IMDb credits are very diverse. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But
okay. Yeah. All right. We love it. Again, this is so, again, Cypherpunk Cinema, he's got a bunch of diverse things as well. There's things that he's like, I don't know about this anymore. But again, yeah, we get it. There's, especially when you're early in Hollywood, you get involved with a bunch of stuff. You do whatever you can. Okay, so let's do this. So you are here, you're a Christian. So one of the things we always ask people who are Christians when they come on the podcast, we ask them kind of what's your story about becoming a Christian? What did that look like for you?
Yeah, it's I became a Christian in Los Angeles, actually. I'm originally from Texas, grew up going to church, and I was part of the ELCA Lutheran denomination, which is has kind of become an incredibly progressive denomination. Like when you see drag queens marching down the middle of a old looking church with stained glass, it's oftentimes ELCA Lutheran church. But I had a great experience in youth group and going to church growing up, but for whatever reason, the gospel just didn't connect with me. I was even I was baptized as a baby, confirmed. And I graduated high school, went to college, and I just was not a professing Christian. I always had kind of like a spiritual feeling about me, but I was more like an appreciator of all religions kind of thing.
Yeah.
And went to college, had like a little bit of a wild freshman year, you know, as you do when you go to college, went to TCU, and didn't go to church a single time my freshman year of college. And then I moved out to LA with some friends who are also filmmakers. This was, I mean, I like talking about years. This was 2002. So I came out to LA, and my best friend, who had become my best friend during this time period, he would wake up every morning on Sundays and just like bolt out of bed. He's like, I gotta go find a church. And you go to church. And I ended up going to, I went with him to visit Bel Air Presbyterian Church. And I guess Tori Spelling, you know who that is, the actress?
Yeah, yeah.
She was there, and I was like, oh, wow, this is crazy. There's like
what
actresses and movie stars at church in Los Angeles.
And a Presbyterian church? What in the
world? Yeah, yeah. So we I came back to our apartment, and I probably heard the gospel in this sermon, and I hadn't been to church in a year. And all of a sudden, it was like all of my upbringing, hearing the gospel, it all connected. And I feel like God just like took a filter off my eyes. And all of a sudden, I completely saw the gospel. I saw Jesus for who he is as God. And I completely believed and became a Christian like in an instant. It was literally like, I think in terms of cinematography, it was like I had a filter over my eyes that didn't allow me to see color. And it was like the filter like was like ripped off. And all of a sudden I saw the world in this vibrant color. And I knew instantaneously that my life had changed, that my behaviors had changed, and that there was no going back. And I just completely believed in Jesus, knew who Jesus was. I mean, I'd heard the gospel my whole life. I even like was strangely drawn to the Bible immediately. And that started a journey. I left LA after the summer, moved back to Texas, went back to TCU, and just joined every Bible study and went to every worship service that I could go to. I was just on fire. And yeah,
wow. That's
how I became a Christian.
Tori Spelling resulted in you becoming a Christian. That is
yeah.
I mean, you probably are one of the only people who can say that, I think, bro.
Yeah.
But so you ended up, what did you study in college?
It was called radio, TV, film at the time.
Okay.
Now it's called film, television, digital media. It's the same major. But yeah, it's like I say that I went to film school or studied film, but you know, that's what the major was.
Yeah. So again, that kind of changes your trajectory. You finish college, you're going to church, you're actively involved in stuff. What did post-college life look like?
I immediately started working in commercial editing, commercial post. And at the time, commercials were shot on 35mm film. They were big budget commercials for Gatorade and stuff. And they would spend, you know, $1 million on a commercial. They'd be like, oh, we're going to shoot this Gatorade spot with this professional boxer. And they would fly to Buenos Aires, Argentina, and shoot it on top of a rooftop, you know. And then they would bring back the actual film, scan a one light. We would edit it offline. And then once we'd finish the spot and lock it, I would fly to Los Angeles to Company 3 to, like, oversee the color correction of it. So that's how far it goes back for me. It was before HD. And I worked in that for 2 or 3 years, and then I just didn't want to be in an office anymore. I wanted to be doing production. So I got out of it and started. I basically became a camera operator on like travel reality shows, which was amazing. Okay. Yeah. I traveled to at least 50 countries over the next probably 5 or 6 years. Yeah. So it was a lot of fun, but it was not, you know. Reality is its own thing, and I really wanted to be in film, so I had to keep pivoting throughout my career.
Got you. Because
it was a long journey.
Keep going, they'll keep giving you jobs in that, and then you know you look back in 20 years, and you're like, I was the travel guy, you know, which is
exactly
something what you want to do with your career. So did you pivot at any point, like into? I mean, did you work on some other, you know, Hollywood films, or did you, you know, what did kind of the things look like?
Well, you know, there were these. I had lots of opportunities to work in Hollywood films. My best friend is incredibly successful in Hollywood, and he became the assistant to some directors. He ended up working on Marvel movies, and he actually could have gotten me a job on the first Thor movie, which is what he went and did. And I, for some reason, I didn't want to be an employee ever. I always wanted to be freelance. So I turned down all those opportunities, and I would just take short stints on shows. So I did some shows for like National Geographic and various television outlets. And, you know, I really at that time wanted to be a commercial director more than I wanted to do like feature length filmmaking. I always saw features as the place I wanted to go, But at the same time, I really needed to make a living. And so it was like, what can I do to have the maximum amount of freedom, still do filmmaking and earn an income? And that kind of led me to doing the type of work that I ended up doing.
Got you. Okay. So, you know, the other thing that we always ask people is, okay, so, you know, we found out how you came to know Jesus. Now, how did you, like, where did Bitcoin enter in here? How did that, you know, that kind of turn for your life? Where did that come from?
Yeah, I always had sort of a libertarian bent to me. And I was just fascinated by how money worked and how some people became wealthy and how, you know, some people essentially lived in poverty. And, you know, I was raised in a fairly middle-class family, and then I went to TCU and I was around a lot of people that were, you know, third generation oil wealth. And so I was around very rich people a lot, and I saw that they behaved in this different way. And I don't know, it just, I was always thinking about those things. And then pursuing the life of a filmmaker, it's not a super lucrative thing in the beginning. It takes a very long time to get your feet under you. And so I was essentially, you know, not making a lot of money. And so I was thinking about money even more because I was at some points like taking on debt, things like that. But I was on a cooking show. And at that time, there was a guy who actually is one of the other cinematographers on What is a Woman and Am I Racist? His name's Andy Patch. And he had been watching the Max Kaiser show, which was pretty popular at YouTube at this time. This was probably 2011, I would say.
Oh, my.
2010, 2011. Yeah. And so he mentioned Max Kaiser. He mentioned Bitcoin. This was, I mean, probably was 2011. And so I started watching the Max Kaiser show. And then anytime he and I would talk, we'd talk about Bitcoin. So we were talking about Bitcoin, especially around 2012, all the time. It was a really fun time because people were kind of talking about what would happen with Bitcoin 10, 20 years out at this time. And they were, you know, they had these grandiose visions of what could happen. It was pretty amazing. So I remember we were trying to figure out how to buy it, and he pointed out Mt. Gox. And so I tried to get an account on Mt. Gox.
Money to Japan, you know?
Yeah. And I never bought Bitcoin during that whole time. And I used to, there was a few podcasts that I listened to. I don't know if anybody remembers this. There was a podcast called Coin Sitter This.
Okay.
And it has been wiped from the internet, but yeah. So it, you know, I was fascinated by Bitcoin this whole time. So at a certain point, I don't know, I guess the price was going up, and somebody posted like, hey, you know, we're all excited, let's remember where we came from. And they posted, I think, the Cypherpunk Manifesto.
Yeah.
And they're like, you need to read like these foundational documents. You should go back and read the white paper. And so I went back and read those things and was just thoroughly convinced. And that was probably around the end of 2016, beginning of 2017.
Okay.
And then it just, an obsession was created. And
it's so what did, I mean, what were you married at this point?
I got married in 2015.
Yeah, okay. So newly married, semi-newly married, you know, what does your wife think when you start talking about, you know, we should buy some magic internet money? How did that conversation go?
That's a great question. Yeah, she was trusting me, but she also could see that I had like gone a little crazy.
A mania. Like,
I'm like staying up till 2 a.m. reading, you know, the Bitcoin Talk forum and telling her about Satoshi. And but yeah, she trusted me on it. But at that same time, I was given a very, very small inheritance from my grandfather, like very small, and it was invested in mutual funds, I think. And I felt this weight of responsibility of, I need to do something with this money. Like, he spent his whole life making this money. He distributed it to all of his grandkids. And I need to somehow carry on the legacy. And that's when I realized I didn't know anything about investing at all. And I also had some debt at the time. You know, I wasn't making a ton of money. We got married, and I felt a lot of guilt because I brought this credit card debt in. So I was like, do I pay off the credit card debt or do I invest the money? And I was asking everyone around me for basically investing in advice, like what is a stock? What is a mutual fund? All this stuff. And I had done some work years before for a company that sold gold. And so I went back and I researched about gold. So I actually started dollar cost averaging into physical gold and silver in 2015.
Wow.
Oh, man. Had I put the same amount into Bitcoin, I would be a multimillionaire. My life would look very different. So she actually was dealing with me. I got a post office box and I was having gold and silver mailed to our post office box every week. And I was bringing home like these little like 1 gram bars of gold and showing them to her. She was totally uninterested. So she had to deal with me during that time. And so it was actually kind of an easier transition when I turned my focus to Bitcoin.
Just don't show me metal again. I don't care. I mean, this is so much better than metal. I'll take it, whatever.
Yeah. And now I do send her some Bitcoin over Cash App every once in a while. So she doesn't really see it like come out of our income, but she does see some amount of Bitcoin be acquired and appreciate. I mean, the appreciation over just the last year, I think right now it's like 127% appreciation. So if you've been dollar cost averaging during that time, all she knows is she like every once in a while gets a little ping on Cash App and she looks and she's like, whoa, like that's a lot of money.
Yep. No, that's awesome. Who are some of the people who, I mean, you mentioned Max and Stacy, you've been listening for a long time with them. Who are some other people as you were, you know, 2016, 2017, you were listening, who are the people who were impacting you and you were, you know, benefiting from back then?
A big one was Andreas Antonopoulos. When he put out all of these talks, which he later compiled the exact same talks into the book, The Internet of Money, I believe.
Yep.
Those were huge. He had gone on Rogan and, you know, showed him a treasure. And so that was a big one for me. And the funny thing for me is that I was a Bitcoin maximalist immediately, but it was around, it must have been around late 2017 or maybe early 2018 when, you know, the ICOs were popping off and there were so many people that were fired up about altcoins that, even though I was like, all this stuff just sounds like fishy scams, I even got swept up in it a little bit.
Dude, we have the same story. It's crazy. Like, it is, like, I mean, very similar. Like, the same thing. I was a maxi from the beginning, got sucked into the, you know, some of the ICOs. Again, this isn't even ICOs. This is just full on altcoins. 2019, you know, for the first 5 months, 6 months that I'm a Bitcoiner, I'm like, well, Bitcoin's the only thing that matters, but these things are pumping like crazy. So yeah, I can totally.
One of the worst things I ever did is I took 0.27 Bitcoin and I invested it into a cloud mining platform. And even Steven, who you know, whose house I'm at right now, I remember I brought up the name to him. He's like, I haven't even heard of that company in a year or two.
Is it called? Do you mind me asking?
It was Genesis Mining. Marco Strong. I can't remember. He had TED talk.
This was the miners were held in Russia or something. Is that guy?
They were Iceland at the time.
Iceland. Oh, okay.
Yeah, there was an account that's still around. A guy that goes by Box Mining. He went and toured them and
okay.
Yeah, when the market tanked, they were like, oh, by the way, in the contract that you signed, it says if the price goes down, then your contract is canceled. And the only good thing, strangely, that came out of that was you had to acquire a certain amount of Bitcoin to have that Bitcoin transaction sent to your hardware wallet. And it was taking too long to get that amount of Bitcoin. It would take 2 weeks or whatever. And you could switch around all these different altcoins. And I saw that you could use Dogecoin and you could get paid in Dogecoin. So I actually flipped it to Dogecoin, totally forgot about it because I was like, well, I just lost this amount of money. And then when Dogecoin pumped, when Elon was talking about it, I actually very quickly created an account on Kraken and cashed out all of the Dogecoin and got like a little bit of money back, and then immediately converted to Bitcoin. And I have not and will never touch another altcoin.
Oh my gosh. See, that's defensible. We you can be forgiven. Andreas. Somebody who's really, yep, Andreas. Who are some of the other people? Were you listening to podcasts? Were you on Reddit this time?
A little bit, yeah. This was during that time when
like fork wars.
Bitcoin was being hard forked, and you know, you had Roger Ver trying to convince people to go BCH, and then there was the Reddit r/BTC versus r/Bitcoin. Strangely, r/BTC was actually for the Bitcoin Cash altcoin failure. I really liked Tur de Meester. Do you know him?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So Tur had a video on how, this was like 2013, how altcoins were a pressure release valve for the price of Bitcoin. So he was actually discouraging people from altcoins all the way back then when there were like 3 altcoins. And then one other one that's a great one to mention is the Tim Ferriss podcast that had Nick Szabo and Naval on it. You wouldn't think, but that one actually kind of, it didn't sell me on any altcoins, but in that same podcast episode, which is a great podcast that anybody should listen to, it's on YouTube. I would recommend listening to one where they've edited out Naval and it's only Nick Szabo talking. But they talk about, I think they talked about like Monero, and they talk about Vitalik Buterin in it. So they had mentioned altcoins in that one too. And it was like, oh, there's these people that I trust. Well, they're talking about these altcoins, and so maybe I'll go and check them out. But
I always had a soft spot for Zcash because Snowden recommended it. I trusted Snowden before I ever got into Bitcoin. And so the fact that he was like, hey, this is better privacy, I immediately was just like, oh, okay. You know, like, I didn't buy any, but I just was always held some sympathy for it in my mind. So at what point you said you're full on maxi from, you know, very early on, but like, I mean, were you talking to family members at this point? Were you, you know, trying to get friends? Like what form, how long did it take for that to happen?
Yeah. I feel like I've orange pilled zero people because I had a nickname at one point where some people call me Tony, and for some reason people called me Tony B, which doesn't mean anything. And then they started calling me Tony Bitcoin. Here comes Tony Bitcoin, because I just wouldn't shut up about Bitcoin. I was talking about it all the time, but I haven't really convinced any of my family members. I'll even send them sometimes Bitcoin over Cash App, which is, it creates an interesting problem for them, because it's like, if somebody just airdrops you Bitcoin, you kind of just created a taxable event for them. Like at a certain point, they're going to have to sell the Bitcoin, and now they have to pay taxes on the capital gains on Bitcoin. Right. So I do that every once in a while. And even my mom sometimes, she'd be like, you sent me, you know, $100 of Bitcoin. I looked and it's $500 now. Wow. Thanks.
Yeah. Do not cast your sats before no coiners is the new don't cast your pearls before swine. That's gonna, you know, yep. We're gonna there's gonna be some like message version of the Bible in 30 years, and that's what they're gonna say. Is this something where it makes me think? There's a friend of ours. Shout to Tim. Tim is a missionary. He works around the world, and for years he was talking to his direct report, his boss, about Bitcoin in a missional context. And basically was saying how, you know, this is really important. And so Tim tells a story of them being in this meeting with all these big missionary organization heads. And his boss, somehow Bitcoin comes up. And his boss goes, yeah, I call Tim Bitcoin boy. And so this is a few years ago. And so then ended up, we did a retreat. We did an event and his boss came with him. And so finally he was in the minority. He was the only non-Bitcoiner there. And so we all get to enjoy, you know, calling him, you know, just basically the fact that, just rejoicing in the fact that all of us got into Bitcoin and that he was basically in the minority. So you've been woefully pathetic in your orange pilling efforts. What do you attribute that to? Do you feel like that's because you were too overzealous, or do you just feel like they're just, you know, people are just busy and they just don't care?
Oh man, I don't know. Maybe my skills of salesmanship are not that great. Max Kaiser will sometimes say that people get Bitcoin at the price they deserve.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wrestle with that one sometimes because I want my loved ones to get Bitcoin at the price they deserve, which is a low price, so that they can, because I think, one day there's going to be a completely new economy that's based around Bitcoin. And if you got in early and if you understand the technology, so I'll oftentimes urge people, rather than to invest, though people ask me sometimes, well, how much should I put in or whatever? And I'm like, rather than putting any amount of money in, here's some resources.
Yep.
So like there's one, I think 10hoursofbitcoin.com. Jameson Lopp has on his website kind of like the first stuff that you need to read as you get into Bitcoin. And I'll tell people certain apps, there are some really good apps that are just, there's hardware wallets for the iPhone, Blockstream Green, Blue Wallet. Cash App is really great. I feel like people don't talk about Cash App enough.
I know. 100% feel the same way.
Yeah, because it's Bitcoin only. It's so easy to buy Bitcoin. And it also doesn't send up any red flags to your bank because let's say your bank is Bank of America or Wells Fargo or whatever. It goes to Cash App first. And so you're just depositing money from one bank account to the other, and you're buying the Bitcoin through Cash App.
Correct. I did this. I'm so glad you mentioned this, because I actually tried to buy Bitcoin just directly through my Cash App without doing that step first, and it got flagged.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized, I was like, oh man, I just need to do the first step. All I have to do is move the money first, and then that won't attract any attention. So again, for all the plebs out there, make sure that you're doing that. So yeah, and then the fact that you don't have to choose between either on-chain or Lightning, that's another.
Yeah.
That makes it feel like magic. I'm just like, I don't know why other people aren't taking that into effect, because it is just so convenient. You can scan any QR code wallet, to pay anything, and it just automatically does the work for you. I just think that's the future. I mean, that's incredible. So totally agree.
Yeah.
So, yeah, go ahead.
Cash App is a good third layer to Bitcoin, because it also gives you a moniker. It's like $, whatever your name is on Cash App. I was in Copenhagen, Denmark recently, and I'd been wanting to do this forever. I've done a few experiments in other countries like while I've been working. So I went to a speakeasy. I actually pulled up, I don't know what it's called, but it's like Bitcoin Map. I just Googled Bitcoin Map. And I pulled up and I'm like, what places in Copenhagen accept Bitcoin? So I found this bar that turned out to be a super cool speakeasy. I wish I knew the name of it, because I'm not going to be able to give them the credit for this, because I don't know off the top of my head. But I went there and it was just a glass building, which the door was locked, and right inside was a bookcase with a bunch of books. I saw a Bitcoin logo on like a sticker on the glass, pushed a buzzer, and they let me in through the bookcase, and it was the most beautiful bar inside. And I sat down, got in this incredible cocktail in this glass with like a bullet sticking through it. And I asked them, can I pay with Bitcoin? They're like, oh, nobody ever asked us. Yes, our owner is super into Bitcoin. He loves that people do Bitcoin transactions. So afterwards, they brought me an iPad, and they're like, you don't have Cash App, do you? I was like, yeah, I do. They're like, oh, okay, good, because that has no fees for us.
Yep.
Did a Cash App, Lightning transaction, paid for the drink. And another thing that's cool about that is, I don't know. I'm not a tax expert, so I don't want to say the wrong thing here, but you're not selling Bitcoin into your bank account and, generating capital gains off that transaction. And you could have used anything. You could have used Blue Wallet or Green Wallet or whatever else.
Yeah. Yeah, Blue Wallet gets slept on too, because they stopped offering Lightning services. And I think for a lot of people there, they just took that to mean that the whole thing wasn't going to work. But I love Blue Wallet. It's great. Okay, so how did you first connect? What did you say the director of Am I Racist and What Is a Woman? What's his name?
Justin Folk.
Justin Folk. So how did you meet Justin? What time period?
I met Justin probably 2015, and Justin kind of recruited me. I'd done some work for Reason TV, yeah. Reason Magazine, and there was another filmmaker, and Justin's company was looking for people who are kind of ideologically aligned, libertarian-ish, conservative-ish, moderate, just not like hardcore progressive type people. And so he'd given Justin my name, and Justin invited me. Their company at the time was in El Segundo in Los Angeles, okay. And it invited me to lunch, and we just got along really great. And then Justin kept finding ways for me to come and be involved in different video projects that they were doing. They had some business clients, and then that turned into the political videos, and we've done so many campaign launch videos for people running for Congress or governor or Senate. And things like that. And during that time period, they got this deal with Adam Carolla and Dennis Prager. And we pitched this movie. We got together, shot a pitch. I can't remember what we put it on, if it was Kickstarter or one of those. And we immediately raised $1 million, I think, and started doing production on this movie, No Safe Spaces, which took a really long time to make, but is a really great movie. And
who is this? Who's this starring? I know I've seen it. I just can't remember what it is.
It's Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla.
Gotcha. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking that was such a weird marriage in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. They're very different from each other. You know, Dennis Prager had the show Religion on the Line. And Adam Carolla, even though he's an atheist, a self-professed atheist, loved listening to this show as he drove around in Los Angeles, and they struck up this friendship, and they're still friends to this day.
All right. So you guys meet in 2015, you work on several projects. At what point does What Is a Woman come along? Is that 2019, 2020?
Yeah. So we started shooting it in 2020, right after kind of the whole country went insane over COVID.
Yep.
So Justin left his company after No Safe Spaces, and kind of he moved from Los Angeles to Colorado, kind of went out on his own. And I don't know how he met Matt Walsh, but somehow they teamed up together. Matt wanted to do a movie on kind of the contagion of transgenderism.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the way that he puts it, but
so
wanted to do this. Justin kind of didn't really want to make a movie about that, but the funds came together. You know, Daily Wire was going to finance the movie, and we all got excited together about it and set off and spent the next year traveling all over America and all over the world making that movie. And it was a smash hit. Yeah. People don't even know how much of a hit What Is a Woman was.
Yeah.
I mean, when they eventually, a year after it came out, when they put it on X, it got 200 million views in a week. Which is an insane number.
Yeah. And is that, okay, so this is just a little, I'm trying to, when you say views, is that just people could have watched a part of it, or does that mean people watched the whole thing? Or like, how do they know? Like, did they give you that full information, or do they kind of just, just tell you one part of it?
I don't know how they quantify it. I listened to a thing where Elon Musk was saying that it's probably actually more than 200 million views because people reposting it or sharing it in different ways.
Sure.
I don't know. But also, so many people had clipped the movie and put it in Instagram reels and stuff. Yeah. And who knows? It's probably more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't trying to downplay it at all. I just was trying to figure out like what that actually means. But no, yeah, I remember thinking, man, this thing is going crazy. Again, it just seemed like it reached a level that very few, at least in my understanding of things, very few conservative things, you know, can reach. And the other thing too, I think just Matt, it's interesting the Matt connection to like the Roganverse to the, I'm even thinking like something like Kill Tony. Are you familiar with Kill Tony?
Yeah.
It's like a comedy show. Like Matt appeals like to this, you know, male between the ages of 25 and 45, you know, there's definitely some similar appeal there. I'm actually half wondering with this Rogan interview, I'm wondering if Matt is going to be on the next episode of Kill Tony or something, if they recorded with him.
He should go on that show.
Totally. That's what I'm saying. Like, it wouldn't surprise me. And again, I guess the bigger picture would be, it doesn't surprise me that there's that level of success, because again, just the war on males, the war on, you know, being a man, you have to bear all this responsibility, and then you get blamed for everything. Like, you get blamed for everything, and then you get nothing, you know, with it. And so, every ill is attributed to you. And so somebody coming along and, you know, skillfully making fun of things, and pointing out how, you know, ridiculous things are, it makes sense to me that there'd be a wide appeal for that. So you do this movie. What are you thinking about how this is going to impact your career? Are you just kind of resigned to the fact that, all right, this is going to rule out, or this is going to shut me off from a whole bunch of future potential projects by me taking part of this?
Yeah, I knew it would. I 100% knew. It was from the day I started working on it that if I put my name on it, it was going to blacklist me to some people. But I also thought, well, anybody who I work very hard, and I'm very loyal to the people that I work with.
Yeah.
And so even if somebody disagrees with me politically, if they're paying me, and if I'm happy to do the work that I'm being paid to do, which I usually am, I'm going to give them everything, and I feel a loyalty to them. So if that same person is going to be like, oh, Anton worked on this project, therefore I'm never going to hire him again, and I don't like him anymore, all right, they're losing my work. And I thought about this logically, that it's probably good that relationship with that person ends if that's how they treat me. So a lot of people didn't put their name on that movie because, like, I'm not going to say who. There was another guy who, he's a filmmaker. He was on basically all of What Is a Woman With Me. And he has a financier who's transgender. And so that person doesn't know that he worked on that movie. And if that person did know that he worked on that movie, a huge part of his career would just disappear, likely. So, yeah, but I'm really glad that I did put my name on it. I'm very proud of the movie. And I feel a massive loyalty to Justin Folk. And I was, I don't know why. It's like something about my personality. If I walk on set, I don't like walk around. Like, if I'm directing, I'm not like, I am the director, or if I'm the DP. Like, I just do my thing. And because of that, I've had people think I'm like a production assistant, or, you know, they don't know that I'm that role because I'm just not carrying myself that way. And they kind of treat me badly as a result.
Yeah.
And maybe because of that, some opportunities kind of haven't been given to me because I haven't played the part enough.
Yeah.
But Justin Folk always honored me in that way, like honored my work as a cinematographer, and was very clear in the beginning of, this movie is yours to dictate the look of the movie. I want you to do it because I love your work.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just feel very honored by that. And so I was thrilled to get the credit of cinematographer on that movie and on Am I Racist? I mean, if you look at my IMDb, nobody's ever really given me that credit on anything else. So, you know,
that's awesome.
Whatever. This is my career now. And yeah.
So what is that? Okay. So again, as somebody, I'm an appreciator of film, but again, I have an increasing number of friends who work in this field. But what does it look like to be a cinematographer? What does this mean? I mean, obviously are you choosing out all the shots? Are you choosing the look? Is this done in communication with the director? I would imagine so. Like, what is everything entailed with being the cinematographer on a film?
There's a saying that I really like that, oftentimes the director is the least experienced person on set. That's not true for Justin Folk. Justin Folk is very technically savvy and a very good director, but I have often worked on things where the person directing kind of sold the project. They've never directed anything in their life. It's just a cool title because as the director, you're the boss.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the person who's the boss at all knows what they're doing. And so oftentimes if a director hires a really seasoned, really good director of photography, then that director of photography is going to block everything, is going to be there behind the camera every single moment. And then the director can go over and speak to the talent. Oftentimes there's other stuff, like you're kind of it's kind of a little bit of a sales job from time to time. You're talking to producers. And so the DP is free to just be there behind the camera, making sure the shots.
The politics. Yeah. Free from the politics.
Exactly.
You just focus on the work. Yeah.
Yeah. And with, you know, I don't think people realize this, but for What Is a Woman, it's a film. And if people haven't watched the movie, they probably think that it's kind of like a cheesier looking movie or just not as polished or not as high budget. I mean, it is a film on all of these. We put a ton of effort into the production value and the cinematography.
Again, like, you can tell the high level of production. Like, I don't think it looks cheesy at all. I think you guys did an awesome job. Is this one of these things, like, who are some of the cinematographers that made you want to do cinematography, that, you know, people you're looking at, you're like, man, how do they do, was it some of that, some curiosity of how do you make things look like that, or just an appreciation of it? What did that process look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I have the people that I'm the biggest fan of. I wish I could remember this one guy's name, because I was just looking at his movies. There's a lot of 90s movies that I really loved. The movie Airborne, the rollerblading movie. Okay. That same cinema, he's a Japanese guy. I cannot remember his name. Okay. But there's a certain look to that era of movies. I really like the movie Dennis the Menace.
Okay.
If you've ever seen that, one with Walter Matthau.
Yep.
Robert Yeoman, the guy who has shot most of Wes Anderson's movies.
Okay.
Big fan of him. And back in the day, like, you know, so many things were shot on 35 millimeter film that wouldn't be shot that way now. Music videos were that way. I don't even always know who the directors of photography were on those things. But yeah, I am a major, major fan of cinema. And, you know, my opportunities right now are doing movies like this, documentaries. I'm doing a lot of stuff for Daily Wire, even some kind of historical travel adventure reality type shows. But they are giving me, you know, they're giving me good budgets. They're letting me shoot on the cameras and lenses that I want. And I don't know. I feel like we're making movies. And
You're making good stuff. And again, I mean, some of the other thing is you're making stuff that's being commercially successful. And so at the end of the day, like, you being a good steward of other people's money is going to end up, you know, with them giving you bigger opportunities. I mean, that just makes sense. Do you appreciate, like, Roger Deakins? Is he somebody who?
Yeah. Oh, one of my absolute top. And I've met him at Cinegear in Los Angeles a few times.
Okay.
Just a great guy. And I mean, he's one of the masters. And I think he's a guy that likes to operate the camera himself. He has a quote that the camera operator is the best job on set, which I agree with. And I love everything he does. I was just watching Shawshank Redemption.
Yep.
Which is one of, you know, I think 95. It's not one of his earliest movies, but just beautiful. Yeah. He's amazing.
Yeah. If you're looking, so like, I've got his IMDb pulled up right now. So like 1917, you know, Hail Caesar, Sicario, Prisoner, Skyfall. I mean, he's directed a ton. I mean, yeah, just a ton of stuff that you would know. No Country for Old Men. I mean, like bunch of stuff. Okay. So then, how much longer after What Is a Woman did you start filming Am I Racist? Where, as far as the idea of that, how much longer did it take for the idea to come together?
In my mind, these things, we haven't been working that long on all of these, but it actually is kind of a long time period. I feel like it was 2021 that we started What Is a Woman. So we've basically been doing these projects for 3 years.
Yeah.
I remember I met the Daily Wire guys when they had an office off Ventura Boulevard in Los Angeles in 2016. I met them when we were doing No Safe Spaces, and I never did any work with them. And then I flew out to Nashville while we were working on What Is a Woman. And it was at a time when all of Los Angeles was shut down.
Yeah.
You had to wear a mask to walk into a restaurant. You couldn't actually sit and eat at a restaurant. Yeah. And I was traveling all over the country, and there were a lot of places that you didn't have to wear a mask anywhere. But I went to Nashville and I walked into the Daily Wire office, and it was this gigantic office with 250 people, and there were no masks, and it was like COVID never happened. And it blew my mind. I could not believe it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that feels like a long time ago to people. That was the time period when I first started working on What Is a Woman. So it's been pretty consistent through there. We had a little break between What Is a Woman and Am I Racist. Am I Racist, I was thinking about this yesterday. we had a finished cut, a rough cut, but a very solid rough cut, in early October of last year. And I mean, there's not a whole, I can't exactly say why this happened, but essentially, the kind of higher ups at the Daily Wire didn't approve of the movie. I think it kind of shocked people. They're like, why is Matt wearing a man bun? And we wanted a sequel to What Is a Woman? And this, like, they couldn't tell if the people in the movie were actors. They thought everybody was an actor. We're like, no, we went and filmed real people. These things really happened. So we had to redo a lot of, there's so many things I want to say that I probably am not really allowed to talk about. There were people in the movie who used to work with Daily Wire who are not currently working with Daily Wire, who we had to reshoot those scenes because it was like,
We know,
it was a long process.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I just could not believe, and this is something that if you haven't listened to the interview that Matt just did with Joe Rogan, Matt Walsh went on Joe Rogan's show and they talked about this, but the fact that you got Robin DiAngelo, I just was dumbfounded. The fact that, and that was like the first part of the movie, right? That was like the first thing you've
done. Yeah. That was really early on. And every single time that we did one of those interviews, we would end it and be like, well, she's going to go and she's going to Google Matt Walsh. She's going to realize she's talking about Walsh. And all those people are kind of connected. And she's going to put out an APB. Hey, Matt Walsh is wearing a wig and he's trying to trick people into getting interviews or whatever. And we're like, we're never going to get another interview. But that never happened. Even after Race to Dinner, those women posted a shot of them all like, hey, we just had this awesome dinner after all that happened.
Oh.
And they put it on their Instagram. It was live. It was on their Instagram until, I think, when the trailer dropped, they pulled it off.
My gosh.
So a year went by and they still didn't know that the person that was there that made them toast to racism was Matt Walsh.
Oh my gosh. So can you give us a little peek behind the curtain? How did you make the, make the DiAngelo interview happen? Like, how did you, who set that all up? And
there's one producer, her name is not in the movie. The reason that her name is not in the movie is because she is just working at Hollywood. And, you know, her whole family has worked in Hollywood for like 50 years.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
And she's just kind of a segment producer type of person who does this for all kinds of shows. Yeah. And she's a woman. And so she would call them and just talk to them. And we gave them a lot of, pretty much all the questions were given ahead of time. Because In the context of the movie, Matt's character is an ally. And so he's not asking adversarial questions. He's like, tell me what you believe. And they're just, they just wouldn't tell people on the more conservative side. It doesn't have to be conservatives. It's just anybody who's not a far left, hardcore progressive, they wouldn't tell those people what they really believe. And so if you're saying you're on their side and just be like, hey, what are the points that you're trying to get across? We all, normal people with logic and critical thinking and common sense, are like, this is lunacy. But to them, it's like their religion. So,
So this girl sets up the interview. Again, she just had connections to her? Or like, I mean, how did, like, what did that look like?
I don't know. She has an agent or something. Yeah. Actually, it goes way further back.
Okay.
So during No Safe Spaces, before White Fragility came out, Justin went to Robin DiAngelo's house and interviewed her in her own house for No Safe Spaces. And so Justin already had a connection to Robin DiAngelo. So somewhere out there, there's an hour-long interview. I don't know. I don't think Adam Carolla was there. I think it was just Justin interviewing her. So we actually had a connection to her from 2016.
Okay. So this, but you weren't filming that. You didn't film that interview.
I didn't film that one. I don't know who Justin filmed that with. She lives in Seattle, and I wasn't a part of that one for No Safe Spaces. Yeah, when you make these documentaries, they take so long. You know, you're filming over a year.
People who are available, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, but you did film the second interview with Robin.
I was the camera angle. She called me in one interview, or I don't know, she put somewhere that the grips wouldn't make eye contact with her. And I love grips. I mean, but I'm not a grip. Yeah. So she thought it was a grip, I guess, because you can see her. She's looking around sometimes of like, any of you guys think this is crazy? So I'm literally standing there facing her, looking at her in that shot. Yeah.
I mean, are you doing that because you're like, this is so funny, I know I'm getting gold, and if I look at her, I'm going to laugh. Is that part of it? Or is this just you're focused on your work? You do.
Oh, yeah. I want to jump out of my skin. I'm so uncomfortable. And I'm still watching it now. I just like, oh, I can't believe we got this. I can't. Well, this is so uncomfortable. So, yeah.
Yeah. I just, again, there's some of the things. I haven't even seen the full movie. I haven't seen the full movie yet, but I just keep finding more clips. And I'm just like, I would have died laughing. Like, there's no way. Like, I would have ruined it. I would have ruined the movie.
Yeah. And Matt is really funny. Like, some of the stuff that he pulls off, you can't even believe. Like, there's a clip from the Rogan interview where Rogan's like, you asked her what mansplaining is, then you interrupted her to say that you disagree and you explained what mansplaining is. And Matt's like, yeah, I was proud of that one. When he did that, that was the time in that interview I was like, oh my God, dude, just do that. And you think it's gonna blow the interview. You think she's gonna be like, okay, I've had enough of this, and like take her mic off. But
yeah,
no, she never did.
But again, yeah, you had already expressed that, you know, you're an ally, and so again, there's like the trust built there. Have you seen any of this debate among like the Christians, like the Christian response to that about like the legitimacy of using deception for something like that?
Yeah. Well, there's I actually responded to a pastor. I don't remember what his name is, but he's kind of the big one that's being referenced.
Okay.
And, you know, he was saying, oh, we lied. And it's not true that we lied. The only time where there was a lie, and I disagreed with it in the moment, and then I understood later why Matt did it this way, and it's in one of the clips that's free online, is when we had the Grieving Your White Privilege seminar. Matt sits down and says that his name is Stephen. But in the context of the movie, he knew that Matt Walsh wouldn't be accepted. And so he gives the name Stephen. But then in that same sequence, at the end, he says, okay, I'll admit it. And they're like, oh, we knew it. And he's like, I am Matt Walsh. And they're like, mm-hmm. So even in that sequence, yes, he did lie. He did say his name was Stephen. But he does come clean in that same sequence. So with getting the interviews, we weren't trying to be deceptive. We weren't trying to make people look stupid. We're just saying, tell us what you really believe, because most people don't ever really hear the full extent of what you believe, and gave them the questions ahead of time.
Was there anybody else maybe was that your favorite element of the film? Was that interview? Were there some other ones that were equally enjoyable?
Yeah, there's other stuff. There's actually a deleted scene. I haven't heard anybody else talk about this scene. Okay. I don't know why nobody else has talked about it. Even Rogan asked Matt if he'd ever worn a mascot costume, and Matt said no. But Matt has definitely worn a mascot costume because, and I'm kind of giving something away if anybody's made it this far in this interview, there is a character. So Matt wrote a children's book called Johnny the Walrus. And there's this scene in Am I Racist? Where we interviewed this woman. She was the highest paid person in the movie. And I physically saw this check and watched it be handed to her. We paid her $50,000 to sit down for a 5-minute interview where she almost didn't say anything. And it's super confusing in the movie because we have the interview with her and then nothing happens afterwards. But what actually happens, the deleted scene that I'm hoping that we put back into the movie when it's eventually released on Daily Wire Plus, we went to a parade in Colorado, a beautiful parade on a small town main street with like girls on horseback waving flags, and there's kids everywhere. And what happened in that story is that that woman was suing for $5 million. She was suing Sesame Street because there's this theme park where it's like a Disneyland for Sesame Street. And this character is coming by and he's like giving kids high fives, and he gets to her kids and he's like, that's the end of the line, and walks off. And she's suing for $5 million, and her kids are in therapy now, and she's suing for damages and said it was racism. Meanwhile, everybody's like, that could have been a person of color inside the costume. Do you even know? She's like,
yes.
I don't know what the race of the person was, but I know it was racism against my kids. So we have Johnny the Walrus walking down the street in this parade, and he's waving to everybody, and he gets this huge group of kids who are all blonde hair, blue-eyed kids, and he just starts throwing them out of the way and like stiff arming them as they're trying to hug him. And then these two little black girls with big curly hair, he sees them, he points, He grabs them, picks them up, spins around, sets them back down. Meanwhile, all the other kids are like, what is going on? He pushes those kids back out of the way and marches off down the parade. And when he comes around the corner, he takes the head off and it's Matt Walsh.
Oh my God.
So he's corrected the wrong. But for some reason, we cut it out of the movie. So I'm hoping that scene, that was one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie. And so I hope it goes back in there.
And you're just like dying laughing as you're filming this thing. Like, are you there with a camera filming this?
Oh yeah. Not only that, we did like 3 or 4 takes of it to get the angles right. And so, and he was not a part of the parade. Like, we did not get permission from this giant parade to do this. So nobody knows why this walrus character is in there, like pushing kids out of the way. It was amazing.
So were any children harmed in the making of this scene, or was this?
No. I mean, this is also kind of giving something away. So it is Matt when he takes the head off, but the character who's pushing the kids out of the way, the little girls, those were his nieces. Otherwise, it'd be kind of weird if he just picked up 2 random kids.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't actually like push the kids hard enough. And I'm like, I want to get a shot in slow-mo of like the big walrus hand like pushing a kid. But so no kids were harmed.
Oh man. See, I was waiting for the lawsuit, you know, coming, you harm my child, you stiff arm my kid. Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Good job for seeing that. Okay, so I vaguely have heard that is there another movie on the way? Are we allowed to talk about this? Is this
There's not another movie on the way that's in production right now. There are lots of ideas in fact, there's one really crazy one that was going to be a fully scripted movie, a feature film. But, you know, I like to think that these question mark titles, that it should be a trilogy.
I like it.
So I'm hoping there'll be another one. I'd be happy to do it if they bring me on for it.
Here's a kind of a personal question. How is the performance of the film been in the movie theaters? I mean, I'm semi-film buff here. So we're hearing lots about, you know, the film industry is dying, you know, box office receipts are going down, down, down. I would imagine this has done decently well. Can you give any, like, I guess, hard information on that? Like, again, without getting...
Yeah, I can.
Just like, yeah.
I can give you the real numbers. I mean, we've been pretty open about it. I say we. I mean, I'm not the one that paid for this movie, but Daily Wire has been pretty clear that they spent about $3 million making the movie. Really, our budget was like 2. Maybe we went a little bit over budget because we had a lot of reshoots. And then marketing, let's call it $1 million. I don't know what the real number is, but... So if the movie made $4 million at the box office, it's a full success. It's in the black. And I know for a fact, opening weekend, it made about $5 million. And we opened on a little bit under 1,500 screens, which to me is a shockingly high number. Yeah. I didn't know how many screens there were in North America. It must be 3,000 or something. So we opened on just under 1,500. And this weekend... we're recording this on Thursday, so starting tomorrow, it's actually opening on some new screens. We lost a few, gained a few, and it's actually more screens this weekend than on the opening weekend. So I don't know. I kind of find it hard to believe that we're going to have the same turnout, but there has been a big swell in marketing, especially with the Rogan appearance. So let's just say it did the same numbers, then it will have made $10 million in the box office. And it will have more than doubled its budget and profit. So a full success by that metric. And then it will also eventually go streaming.
Yep.
I'm hoping they open up some other ways of it being seen. Like, I'm hoping What Is a Woman goes on a streaming service where you can buy it just like any movie that doesn't exist yet, but I kind of have a feeling that
like
they're
Amazon Prime or something, I could see something like that.
Yeah.
Although they've been restricted. I don't know. Again, we'll throw it at Indie Hub. Shout to Zach. Let's go. If you know what Indie Hub is, go check it out. Come on.
Yeah. Man, it would crush. What Is a Woman was on Indie Hub? Oh, I would love that.
Dude, why couldn't you do that? Let's do it. Come on. It's already a couple years old. It'll give it a new boost among the Bitcoin demographic. Let's go.
If it was mine to put on, I would do it. I think it's technically property of Daily Wire, so it's theirs to do it. But yeah, the Indie Hub model is awesome.
Yeah, love it. Go check out Indie Hub if you haven't heard of that. INDEHUB. Are there other projects that are kind of, I mean, I know you're not like a director. Is directing something you want to do at some point? I mean, I think you mentioned in the beginning, it is something that eventually, and you're still hoping to get there. Has this kind of opened up any of those doors yet, or is it still kind of something down the road?
I would say it is opening that door. I've done my own filmmaking with short films and comedy sketches and things like that. I have not done my own feature yet. I pitched a family film to Daily Wire, and I am currently in the process of doing what is essentially a proof of concept. It's a short film. It's a proof of concept. It's a kids adventure movie. My favorite genre of movies are kind of movies that appeal to 10-year-old boys. Just, I was born in the early 80s. So the mid-90s to me was that time period of, you know, it was when The Sandlot came out. I was just watching with my son the movie Heavyweights.
Little Giants.
As I said before, Little Giants, Dennis the Menace, Mighty Ducks.
Mighty Ducks, let's go.
That era of movies was so good. Those movies had big budgets, and they were fun to watch with the whole family. But as a kid, you didn't feel like it was being dumbed down to you.
Yeah.
And I mean, I would love to be making that kind of movie. So I wrote a feature film that is a very adventurous. It's like if Sandlot met the Goonies. And I have pitched it to Daily Wire. It's not in production right now, but I'm doing a proof of concept. It's kind of based in that same world. It takes place, the movie itself takes place in the mid-90s. Okay. It has a lot of nostalgia, like the kids use the neon yellow and green Super Soaker, and they ride Huffy and GT BMX bikes and stuff like that. So I'm making that to show it to the Daily Wire to try and get them. Maybe they'll want to make a kids feature film for Bentke. So, yeah, I do believe that it is going to lead to more opportunities like that. At the same time, I am working on some other projects with them that are not family films and kid-related.
Okay.
I did the cinematography for the Foundations of the West series that had Jordan Peterson show.
Yeah.
Ben Shapiro, Jonathan Pageau, Spencer Clavin.
Cool.
Bishop Barron, although I didn't shoot that episode. And then we did another project with Ben Shapiro when he went and met Elon Musk in Poland at Auschwitz.
Yep.
That hasn't come out. I don't know exactly what we're going to do with that yet, but there's some other projects in the works. So I'm just happy that they keep giving me stuff like this to do. I love working with them. I love them as a company. And yeah, and if Matt Walsh wants to do another movie and he wants to have me on the crew, that would be awesome. How about that?
Well, awesome. Anson, thank you so much, man. Appreciate your time. Tell people where they can find you, find your work, and follow your work. And we mentioned your IMDb. Where else beyond that?
Well, I would say X. It's just Anton Syme, my name. Pretty much my name on every single platform, Instagram. Although I don't exactly use my YouTube at the moment. I have a lot of older stuff that I did, you know, 12, 15 years ago on there. I mean, you could subscribe to me on YouTube. I have some stuff coming up on that. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome.
Thanks for having me on.
No, of course. And thank you guys for listening to another episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast. I want to just recommend two of our sponsors to you again. River is the place we recommend people to buy Bitcoin. You can buy Bitcoin at river.com/TGFB. If you're new to Bitcoin and you're saying, hey, I'm not even ready to buy yet, River has a Learn tab on their website where you can they have a bunch of resources where you can get answers to all kinds of questions that you might have. They only sell Bitcoin, which basically means that unlike a lot of platforms, something like Coinbase or some of these other things, they are leaving in the short term, you know, millions of dollars on the table by not selling all these, you know, multitude of altcoins, as we talked about before. And so we love to honor people who are, you know, acting in the best interest of their customers over the long term. The other sponsor would be CrowdHealth. If you use promo code CrowdHealth at checkout, basically you can get up to 30%, I think even a little bit more than 30% off your first 3 months of membership there. CrowdHealth is basically trying to fix what is wrong with the American health insurance industry. You can find out more information on their website. Andy is a Christian, the founder, and they do an awesome job. We are grateful for you guys and look forward to having you on the next episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast. See you next time.